Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Rethreaded offers hope and a fresh start to survivors of human trafficking right here in Jacksonville. None of us should be defined by the worst things that happen to us. Learn more about how you can unlock the potential of survivors at Rethreaded.com. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strive to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist and professor of health system sciences. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, our season 3 premiere on the latest on obesity and weight loss treatments, from Ozempic to surgery for kids to adults. And later, an illustrious group of weight loss doctors answer your questions. But first, whether we choose to acknowledge it or not, obesity is a huge problem in the United States. And this is especially true in kids. Roughly 1 in 5 children in the United States between the ages 2 and 19 is affected by obesity, meaning that they have a body mass index, or BMI, at or above the 95th percentile for their age and sex based on CDC growth charts. Childhood obesity, adult obesity, all seems to have increased during the COVID-19 pandemic. Though mounting evidence suggests that people can be healthy at any weight if they do enough physical activity, obesity in both adults and children carries both immediate and long-term risks. Children and adults with obesity can be metabolically healthy, meaning they have normal blood sugar, cholesterol, blood pressure, and waist circumference. However, we're seeing more children diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, high cholesterol, and high blood pressure, and obesity is a strong risk factor for all of these conditions, both in childhood and adolescence, and then later in adulthood. Now, as a result, the American Academy of Pediatrics recently provided new guidance on childhood obesity, the first in 15 years, moving away from watchful waiting or delaying treatment to see if children outgrow obesity. But we want to start our show today with Gabriella, or Gabby, who shares her journey of life-saving weight loss therapy. Now, she prefers not to use her last name, so we don't identify her. But Gabby, we are so happy to have you on our show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Gabby, let's start off with you sharing your personal journey of managing obesity and the strategies that were most effective for you.
I have had weight issues since I have been 15. I had some personal tragedy at that age, and it seemed that emotionally something happened and I started gaining weight. And over the last 30-something years, I have been basically weight recycling. And I have met this wonderful lady, Dr. Nemes, which has been able to guide me and encourage me through the process. And I actually give her, you know, most of the credit on this. I worked hard for it, but without her, I don't think I would be able to do it.
Gabby, what was the thing that inspired you to say, I need help, I need treatment for this?
So I was one of those COVID other victims, in the sense that I did fairly well during most of the pandemic. And in February of this year, I went on the scale and I was 25 pounds heavier than when I went to give birth with my son. Almost at the same time, I had done my blood work and my A1C was at pre-diabetic range. And I realized that if I don't do anything about this now, it's going to be a bigger problem. And my other thing was my knees were absolutely killing me, even going up and down the steps in my house. And at that point, I realized that I just can't do this by myself.
How did all of this, and you just mentioned it when you talked about your knees, but how did it impact your health? Did you find yourself more ill, or was it just the pain of walking that kind of impacted you? What was that? How did it affect you?
The pain of walking was definitely, I would say, the biggest of the problems. I was hurting on a daily basis and getting tired going up the steps. And just that unwell feeling, I guess that's the best way I could say it.
How, without me being too nosy, but I'm going to ask this, because if I was in a medical office right now, I would know it because the data would have been checked. How high of a weight did you get to?
239, and I'm 5'7".
God.
And I'm 51, just God. To give you the whole array.
No, that gives me a sense of just the struggle with all of this. To anyone who's out there who's listening you describe this, I mean, what would be the first thing that you would say advice-wise to someone struggling with their weight?
First thing is go and reach for help. There's a number of people out there, especially now, I think that people are becoming a lot more aware, as you are mentioning, of the obesity epidemic in this country. And just go reach for help. That's the first thing I would say.
So what kind of treatments or strategies did you do to help you?
So as Dr. Nemes advised me, we basically took a multi-pronged approach. I actually did therapy. I started using metformin. I just started using Ozempic. So basically 7 months into it, that was not our first, resource. Exercising and becoming more aware of being healthy. So not looking at obesity. I think that as a woman, my tendency has always been to look at the size jeans that I would fit in, as opposed to, oh my God, my cholesterol is high. Oh my God, my A1C is high. It was always, oh, I'm going to exercise to lose weight. It was not, I want to be healthy. And I think that that first change of perspective was very important to me personally.
How did the extra weight that you gained, how did it impact your relationships with your family, your friends? What did it do?
I was basically embarrassed. I saw a bunch of pictures that were taken at Christmas time. And let me tell you, it was not pretty what I saw. It was basically, I was a stuffed sausage in my clothing. And that did not look good. So it made me withdraw from my family.
Weight loss is such a tough thing. And is there anything that served as an inspiration or motivation, if you will, to keep you going on the journey with this?
I started listening to a podcast and being able to see a professional that basically was my cheerleader. And we would talk every week and we'd measure how much weight I lost and doing body measurements. And I was always panicking when I lost a half a pound. And I was like, oh my God, I was doing all these things. And why is it that I'm not seeing the result? And she was the one saying, okay, you know, half a pound is better than nothing. It's, you know, you, as long as you progress as you're going and you're moving in the right direction, that's what really matters. And I think that motivates you to keep going, as opposed to say, well, since I didn't lose any weight, let me go have a piece of pastry.
Now, you mentioned Ozempic, and we're going to be talking about Ozempic and Wegovy and surgeries for this. But how effective was that for you?
I just started 5 weeks ago.
Okay.
So keep that in mind. I'm not sure what the long-term effect would be. But as of right now, I've lost weight. And it seems that your satiety is majorly affected. And taking Ozempic has reduced my cravings. One of my biggest problems has been my cravings for sweets. That's how I deal with emotion. I'm upset, I'm going to eat a piece of sweet. I'm happy, well, let's celebrate. So being able to manage that, it's a lot easier to not reach for a piece of sweet when your body's not working against you.
And you don't have those cravings now?
They are decreased to maybe 10%.
Okay. Did you think about more aggressive treatment?
I'll be honest with you, no.
Was there it just out of not knowing or out of fear? Just from my own curiosity.
Out of fear, and I have a few friends that have done it amazingly successfully, and I have a few friends that have health issues. So I feel like it's a toss up for me, and I felt that I'm going to try everything that I know how before I reach to that.
Gabby, I'm going to ask you this question. I know you asked us just to identify us by your first name, but my question has to do almost on that. Is there stigma?
Absolutely. It's, people look, they associate being heavy with being lazy, with not having willpower, with not wanting to make the sacrifices to achieve the weight loss. And, people would say, oh, well, but then just stop eating sweets. Okay. This is not as easy as that.
What do you think has been the biggest misconception that the public may have about being overweight that they just don't understand?
That you don't apply yourself, and that's why you are overweight.
Did you choose to do, in addition to Ozempic, other things too? Did you change diet and activity?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned before, I did therapy that addressed some of the emotional baggage that I haven't dealt with in the past that would lead me to go to sweets as opposed to addressing whatever negative emotion I had. That was one exercise, absolutely. And I switched more towards lifting weights as opposed to doing aerobic exercise. I decreased the aerobic exercise. And I did, like I said, the metformin as well. And absolutely changing the diet. You can't, in my opinion, in my experience, I don't think this is a one approach solves the problem. You can't do just diet, just exercise, or just medication. You have to do all of them.
As you look to the future, what's your goal and/or hope, if you will, for your journey in terms of managing the weight?
I would like to definitely keep up the exercise and stay aware and not be in denial, in the sense that instead of figuring out that you gained 10 pounds, you're figuring out that you gained 40 pounds. So not go to the other extreme where people go on a scale every day, but weigh yourself once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks, depending what your emotional setup is around that, and stay on top of it.
To our listeners who are basically going down the same journey, and there's many, there's so many, because this is such a common and popular topic. What do you want to make sure that they know, that now that you know about, well, you've been dealing with this, you're on medication for it. What advice do you have for them?
You know, one thing that I actually didn't know was a complete new concept to me was eat your protein first. If you have a plate of food, eat the protein first, and not all calories are equal. So if you eat 500 calories in cake or 500 calories in steak, it's not the same thing on your body. And I always thought that is that calories in, calories out, that is the way you look at the concept of weight loss. And that was something that I absolutely did not know about until this year.
Gabby, I wish you the very, very best in your journey as you manage this. I hope that it all works out beautifully. And I just really want to thank you for being so nice to share your story with all of us, because I know it'll help a lot of people out there.
Thank you, and I really hope so.
We've been talking to Gabriella, or Gabby. She is someone struggling with weight and is currently on Ozempic, and she shared her story with us. And we'll be right back. To all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJZT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, it's our Season 3 premiere, and we're talking about obesity and weight loss, and we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tweet me at jservin. We now add some expert medical voices to our discussion. Joining us now are Dr. Beverly Chang. She is an assistant professor of clinical medicine at Weill Cornell Medicine. Dr. Chang, welcome.
Hi, Dr. Servin. Thank you for having me.
It's so good to have you here. We also have Dr. Gustavo Villalona. He is a pediatric surgeon at Namur and Wolfson's Children's Hospital here in Jacksonville. Dr. Villalona, thanks for joining us in studio.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you, Dr. Servin.
It's great to have you here. Last but not least, we have Dr. Isaac Motomeri. He is a bariatric surgeon at North Florida Surgery and a general surgeon as well. Dr. Motomeri, welcome to our program, and thank you for coming in studio as well.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Servin.
It's so good to have you all here. Dr. Chang, I'm going to start with you. We just heard Gabriella's story. How, for our listeners out there, define obesity and how common it is in adults and kids.
First, I'd like to say that Gabby is incredibly brave to share her story. And I think it will really resonate with the hundred million Americans who have obesity. We know that the latest numbers show us that more than 40% of United States adults have obesity. And there are studies projecting that number to be 1 in 2 individuals in the US by the year 2030. And we define obesity right now by a metric we call the body mass index. This is essentially a measure of your weight and your height and assessing whether you are underweight, normal weight, overweight, or whether you have obesity. When that body mass index, or BMI for short, is 30 or greater, that's when we diagnose obesity.
And I take it that it's rampant.
It is rampant. Like I said, more than 100 million Americans have obesity. You mentioned childhood obesity, 1 in 5 children also have it as well. And so, as Gabby pointed out earlier, it is probably our most challenging epidemic today.
Dr. Villalona, you are in a pediatric setting. Do you define being overweight, obesity in adults and kids equally? Is it the same way we use the same definitions, or is it done slightly differently in a kid's population?
That's a good question. When we talk about obesity in kids, we still use the BMI or body mass index, just as we do for adults. However, as you know, kids are constantly growing and changing. So because of that, we cannot just use a simple number. We actually have to compare it to something. So what we do instead is we compare the BMI to children that are the same age and sex and compare it using our growth charts. And if the child BMI is greater than the 95th percentile of kids the same age and sex, then we say they're obese. And we can further subdivide that classification with class 1 obesity with kids who have a BMI over 30, class 2 obesity with a BMI that goes between 35 to 39, and sort of the worst group with severe obesity have a BMI over 40.
Dr. Motomari, we heard Gabby describe what led her to get help, but why do we, and I'm going to say collective we in the medical world, worry so much about this? What are the consequences of obesity?
Well, I think it's definitely a very important topic because obesity is associated with a multitude of health issues. As Dr. Chang had said earlier, you know, about 40% of the population is dealing with the epidemic of obesity. And it's related to multiple health conditions such as hypertension, diabetes, obstructive sleep apnea. All these health issues affect patients at multiple levels and work to really affect their quality of life. And that's the main issue we're dealing with here is just their overall health. You know, when we talk about losing weight, we have to think about it in terms of gaining health. And a patient such as Gabby is a great example of that, is somebody that's looking to get their quality of life better, whether it's psychological or just from a basic management of something such as diabetes or hypertension.
Dr. Chang, we talk about the health risks. We heard just a second ago why we worry about this. Are the health risks for a kid different than an adult who presents with being overweight or obesity?
You know, Dr. Servin, I am an adult endocrinologist, so I want to be careful to stay in my lane here.
Gotcha.
But I do recognize that childhood obesity, of course, predicts adult obesity. And we can see this as early as infants, as they fall off the growth curve, so to speak. And my patients can offer so many personal experiences of how, just like Gabby, that obesity started affecting their life at a young age, and that they've experienced that trauma, so to speak, and all of the challenges associated with obesity, the weight stigma, social and physical health issues since that age and for decades thereafter. Many of my patients are similar to Gabby, where they are 50 years old or so by now. And so the consequences, I think, do accumulate both physically, mentally, socially. So by the time that I see them in my adult clinic, we're dealing with some complicated cases.
Understood. I know, Dr. Motomari, you do bariatric surgery, so you deal with some of these patients. We heard Gabby, she talks about the stigma and how socially this is hard. How you're on a very aggressive way of managing the condition. Do you try to integrate mental health support in those situations?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, having patients set up a support system, having them set up some counseling beforehand, you know, that's actually a requirement by multiple insurance companies to move forward with bariatric surgery. You know, if you look at obesity, you know, Gabby hit on a lot of different things. She talked about body image issues. She talked about quality of life issues. You know, if you look at patients that are undergoing bariatric surgery, about 50% of them have previously had mental health treatment. And for a multitude of reasons, whether it's some sort of emotional neglect or some sort of sexual abuse, you know, there are lots of deep-rooted problems that affect patients and manifest as obesity. We are thinking we're only treating the health problems, but really we have to dive deeper to get to the root of the problem.
Understood. Dr. Villalona, I know you do some surgeries in kids as it pertains to weight management. I'm curious, are other than an aggressive strategy in surgery, are there effective strategies to prevent this in kids that can be incorporated for folks that, you know, don't want to go down this route if they have a choice?
Yeah, that's the holy grail.
Right.
but we think it all starts with good nutrition. And I think it's important for children to make sure they eat a well-balanced diet of whole foods with fruits, vegetables, grains, and lean protein. I think the biggest impact that that could be recommended to start with is just cutting back on processed foods. So less sugary drinks, decrease fast food, decrease snacks that are unhealthy. You can also teach parents and their kids about portion control, making sure that to eat the right amount of food, not use food as a punishment or reward. Eat scheduled regular meals as a family is very important. Physical activity. You got to stay active, and the family has to be all participating in this. And the recommendation is to do at least 1 hour every day of activities with your children.
Wow.
Screen time. We know that the American Academy of Pediatrics recommend for the use of screen time for less than 2 hours per day. So if you can limit the amount of screen time your children are using, it's very important. And sleep is, I think, one of the biggest ones, because we know lack of sleep has an important role in dysregulating or affecting the hormones that are related to hunger and satiety. So you're making sure that the kid is getting the appropriate amount of hours of sleep.
Great advice. Dr. Chang, one of the biggest questions we all get is genetics. Is if you look at your parents and they're overweight, I mean, are you beholden? What is the genetic component to obesity?
That's such a great question. Researchers now, depending on the type of study, estimate 20 to 80% of a person's weight can be determined by genetics. And that is a very wide range, but I think that reflects the heterogeneity of the disease and how each person's personal struggle with obesity can be due to their lifestyle, certainly. And those are the people who do start healthy eating, whole foods, all of that, and they see that weight loss success. Whereas others may be doing all the right things, quote unquote, and they are still not seeing the results that they want. And so when we think about genetics, we do have to think about it in the context of any other characteristic of ourselves. Right? If we have high blood pressure as another chronic disease, that could be because we have a lot of salt in our diet, or all of our parents also had high blood pressure. And so we see that there is a strong genetic component there. And that's one of the reasons why obesity is a true medical disease and not a lifestyle choice.
Let me get into the area of medications. There is not a single day that I do not hear something about a version of semaglutide, which is now under Wegovy or Ozempic, and the shortages and the demand. In fact, at the day of that we have having this conversation, there's a lawsuit being filed over the compounding pharmacies to provide this. So, Dr. Chang, I'm going to ask you, can you just give us a little bit of an overview about these weight loss medications?
Absolutely. So there are currently 5 FDA-approved anti-obesity medications for regular obesity individuals with that BMI of 30 or greater. And that threshold can shift a little bit as well if you have other weight-related comorbidities like hypertension and high cholesterol. As you mentioned, I think the medications that are most present in the public nowadays are the injectables. Those are also known as GLP-1s, which is a peptide, a protein that our gut produces to help us feel full. So Gabby mentioned that she was feeling improved satiety on the medication and also improvement in cravings. These medications that are known generically as semaglutide or under their brand names of Ozempic or Wegovy are known to improve that feeling of fullness, to reduce appetite, and many, many patients experience an improvement in their cravings as well. I just want people to keep in mind that Ozempic is the brand name that is FDA approved for diabetes, while Wegovy is the one that's FDA approved for obesity. And so when individuals take Ozempic for weight management but do not have diabetes, that is considered an off-label use.
I want to go to now beyond the meds. And before these meds came out, we were all talking more about weight loss type of surgery. So I'm going to ask you, Dr. Motamary, can you give us a kind of a somewhat simple overview of the different types of bariatric surgery that are available?
Sure. Per the ASMBS, our governing body for metabolic and bariatric surgery, the approved surgeries are the sleeve gastrectomy, which is a procedure where we make the stomach smaller, giving patients essentially a reasonable amount of portion control, and it allows them to control their cravings. The next surgery approved is the gastric bypass. It's a surgery a little bit more complicated, but we're able to make a small pouch out of the stomach and reroute the intestines to affect some of the absorption and delay some of the digestion, digestion absorption of foods within the body. And another procedure approved, gastric band. It's a restrictive procedure, but that limits your oral intake. A simpler of the procedures, but a procedure nonetheless. Now, as we move on in complexity, we start looking at procedures such as the duodenal switch, which is by far the best for complex diabetes. And it is a combination of a sleeve and a gastric bypass is probably the easiest way for me to put it. And then finally, a newer surgery that we just had approved called the SADI, which is basically a sleeve plus anastomosis of the duodenum down to the ileum, another good procedure to help with weight loss.
Given these meds, do you wait for people to have tried these meds that we talked about a moment ago before they go to surgery, or can surgery go ahead of that?
Sure. So, you know, I'd say that, you know, starting the conversation about weight loss is a challenging one. And so when you have a patient come to you and say, well, they're 20 or 30 pounds overweight, then you're giving them different options. Now, in my sake, I have patients come to see me 100, 150, maybe 200 pounds overweight. And that's, you know, a whole different category of patients. Those patients would definitely benefit from surgery first, but you could also try medications as a bridge. A lot of times by the time they've met me, they have tried diet lifestyle changes first, as well as medications, and have been unsuccessful.
Dr. Villalona, I mentioned the pediatric guidelines, and those new guidelines, they really go to fairly aggressive treatment. So I'm wondering if you can kind of help us on the young end of the scale. What's your take on those guidelines, and what's the youngest age that one should be approaching the surgery versus these meds? Can you kind of give us, as you practice in this area, how you go about it in making those decisions?
I think those guidelines are very important. I think that the American Academy of Pediatrics is sort of the governing body of like sort of everything, anything we do in pediatrics, whether it is the medical side and the children's side. And those guidelines came about the long-term results of the bariatric surgery in children and the outcomes and the significant improvement in the comorbidities that were shown based on those findings. The specific age of this treatment can vary, and that could be due to different indications or conditions. So the current recommendations for interventions, and these interventions are the sleeve gastrectomy and the gastric bypass, although we usually recommend just the sleeve gastrectomy because it's only a restrictive procedure and you don't deal with the consequences of the malabsorption of vitamins and other nutrients sort of long-term in a growing child. So the surgery can be done as young as 12 years of age for boys and girls. But in cases of severe obesity with extreme obesity related health issues, you can do the surgery as young as 6 years of age.
And wow.
Yeah, there's good data coming out of Saudi Arabia where they've done these procedures, and children with severe obesity and diabetes, hypertension at that age, and these conditions can be reversed by the surgery, and that's why the guidelines came about. In fact, there's comparison of the outcomes of the comorbidities between if you do the surgery when you're young versus when you're old, and the remission of diabetes if you have the surgery when you're an adolescent. 10 years later, you achieve a 70% remission in diabetes. That means you don't have diabetes anymore. When you do the surgery in an adult, 10 years later, the remission rate is about 50%. So it seems like doing the surgery earlier or doing these interventions earlier allows your body to recover in a more sustainable and long-term way.
In our last moment, I'm going to go round robin with each of you and ask, what's the one advice you want to make sure that our listener takes home, if you will, in terms about this issue that you would want them to know? So I'm going to start with you, Dr. Cheng, briefly. What advice would you have for our listeners out there on this topic?
I think the one take-home point goes back to what Gabby had said, that this really isn't a journey that you have to do alone. Obesity is a medical disease. We have new evolving options for treatment, not just medications, but bariatric therapies, bariatric surgeries. And as Gabby experienced, that treatment must be personalized. So what works for one person may not work for another. And you really should seek professional help. And you can find those individuals at the American Board of Obesity Medicine Organization who can help guide you in that personalized treatment.
Dr. Motomari, what's your doctor's advice for the day?
Well, I'd like to reiterate what Dr. Cheng said. And she's absolutely correct. You know, making sure that when you're seeking help in a matter that you go to a reputable source or a reputable program. So if it's an online source to find a primary care or a pediatrician, that you find somebody that's willing to talk to you about this and somebody that has experience in this. Sometimes our primary care is over inundated with multiple health issues and they don't have the time to address something that's causing these multiple health issues. If you find somebody that understands that obesity is an underlying issue in all of these and makes that a priority, then you will find somebody that will help you along the journey.
Dr. Villalona, you get the last word today.
Yeah, I get to reiterate what they say. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there with social media, with regular media. I think the importance of seeking medical help, whether it's your pediatrician or your adult doctors or a dietitian that can help you and guide you through the process, and identifying what type of treatment or types of treatment will be the best one for you, because there's not a one shoe doesn't fit all here. So it doesn't mean that everyone needs surgery, or it doesn't mean everyone needs Ozempic. I think each patient has an individual reasons why they need help, and with seeking medical assistance, we can identify those issues.
Well, let that be our last word. I want to thank you, Dr. Cheng, you, Dr. Motomari, and you, Dr. Villalona. This has been absolutely terrific.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you.
You bet. It's been great. We've been talking to Dr. Beverly Cheng. She's an assistant professor of clinical medicine at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York. Dr. Gustavo Villalona, a bariatric and general surgeon here at Wolfson's and Nemours Hospital. And Dr. Isaac Motomeri. He is a general surgeon and bariatric surgeon at North Florida Bariatrics. Our next guest, Dr. Madeline Joseph, is professor of emergency medicine and pediatrics, medical director for the UF Pediatric Weight Management Center here at the UF College of Medicine in Jacksonville. Dr. Joseph, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
How common is pediatric obesity?
Unfortunately, it's very common. So it is 1 in 5 children and or teens are impacted by this disease. And when we want to give it a number, 14.7 million children and teens are impacted by this disease in our country.
Wow. Let me ask just a quick question before I leave the definition. You know, I was talking with others and someone brought up the point that BMI can sometimes be a very clunky value or metric. I know that's how it's defined, but does that have any impact on how, you know, how this definition has come to kind of have so many people diagnosed with it?
Absolutely. So BMI is linked to adiposity, you know, meaning the percentage of fat in our body. On the other hand, there is limitation to it since, you know, some of the athletes that may have a big muscle mass, they may their BMI may be high. But it is the tool that we have at this point. But I can tell you in our clinic, we do use a scale that actually looks at not just the BMI, you know, for children, but also their muscle mass, as well as the fat percentage of their body. So that really gives you a little bit more accurate description of what is happening in the body. But the literature is using the BMI for all these studies because you know, they felt like it's a good screening tool. And for the most part, it is associated with some of the other tools that we have, like the DEXA scan or others that tells us about the adiposity.
So when you were talking about all those children that are diagnosed with pediatric obesity, is that all kids, or are there certain demographic groups that are more impacted than others?
And that's a great question. So in general, 1 out of 5 child or adolescent is impacted by obesity. But if you want to look at, you know, some of the racial or ethnic groups, 26% of Hispanic children are impacted by obesity, and 25% of Black children are impacted by obesity, in comparison to 16.6% of non-Hispanic white children. But I do want to caution us, you know, this is not necessarily related to race, because race is not a biological, you know, proxy for disease, but it is due to the, you know, probably access to care, access to healthy food, access to parks where the kids can play and be physically active in a safe manner, and also the toxic stress. So children who are experiencing adversity, there's changes in their hormones that regulate weight. And so we really have to look at like all these factors that really contribute to increase the prevalence of obesity in certain racial or ethnic groups.
How do these new guidelines differ from the past ones? I mentioned already that these are much more aggressive, but can you walk us through some of the high points of those guidelines?
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to state, you know, when you say aggressive, I just want to maybe comment on that, because I do see it in social media. It is not aggressive. It is really a shift from going from watchful waiting, where we hope that the child that's struggling with obesity will outgrow it. But truly, the evidence are telling us that children, specifically teenagers who are struggling with obesity, they're going into adulthood with obesity. So that's really not going away. And so the watchful waiting, that hoping things are going to get better on its own, is really not working. You know, when we say aggressive, it's really not aggressive, but it's actually paying attention to it. And the first thing the guideline actually recommend is intensive behavior health and lifestyle treatment. And that actually indicates almost 26 hours of intense one-on-one, you know, with the child, with the family, for behavior modification. So that's, so we're not jumping into surgery or medications, you know, right away. And so that's probably the biggest difference between the old guidelines in 2007 and the current guidelines, is really going away from the watchful waiting to, you know, intervening early. And I can tell you, in our clinic, unfortunately, we see 6-year-old, 7-year-old with prediabetes. And so these type of complications of obesity are happening at such an early age. And therefore, the intervention is really critical.
There has become a somewhat of a phenomenon, certainly in adults, with new weight loss drugs, particularly semaglutide, which is an injection that is now done for weight loss. And it seems like it's become somewhat of a weight loss phenomenon, particularly because of TikTok and other social media outlets. What do we know about using something like this in kids?
I mean, obviously, there is room for, you know, medications, especially if the child has severe obesity. So not just obesity, but severe obesity, meaning like their BMI more than 30% or more than the 120% of the 95th percentile, you know, for their age and gender. And so it's for severe obesity. And there's one study that was published last year that looked at using it in the younger children over 12. And it did show, you know, compared to intensive lifestyle, you know, changes, that the BMI actually changed 16% in the semaglutide versus only 0.6% in the placebo group. So it is showing, you know, good results. But you have to understand, you know, a couple of things. I mean, one, when we start medication, because obesity is a chronic disease, you're really committing, you know, that patient to being on this medication, like, you know, for a long time. And so it's really critical that, you know, even if we started medication, that we continue the other modality that we know it works, like the intensive behavior health and lifestyle modification and motivational interviewing, you know, as well, where the counseling is actually to identify and reinforce the person's own motivation to change. And so we are not telling people what to do or the patient what to do, but we're actually looking at what motivates that person to make a change and building, you know, on that. And that's really actually very powerful. And so, again, the medication does have a role, but it would be with severe obesity and with other modality of obesity treatment, because all medications have side effects. So even with the semaglutide, 4% of the patients that were treated developed gallbladder stones.
Oh, wow.
You know, compared to zero in the placebo group. So we you know, we have to be careful, you know, as we prescribe these medications.
What message do you want to make sure that our listeners take away from our discussion and these new guidelines regarding pediatric obesity? What message do you want to make sure people take away from all of this?
I just want to emphasize that there's so much stigma against, you know, people with obesity and children with obesity, and that could be lifelong. And so the good news is, you know, we do have options, you know, for treatments that are effective that we can offer families. And I just want to empower the families to, you know, feel free to ask your pediatricians about what treatment is available and what is best for my child. And so it's a chronic disease, but we can treat it. And I do want to say there's a really great resource for parents. It's the AAP, American Academy of Pediatric, healthychildren.org.
Okay.
And there's really many, much information that would be useful for parents of children who are suffering from obesity.
Dr. Joseph, I want to thank you so much for coming on our program and talking to all of us about such a huge and important topic. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. A special shout out to Dr. Amy Hessler for recommending this topic. I also have a special thank you to you, all of our listeners, for trusting us to provide you answers for your healthcare questions. Our executive producer is David Luckett. Brady Corum is our director. Stacy Bennett is our producer. Next week's program is our monthly medical roundtable. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, email us at health@wjct.org, or tweet me at jservin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. The American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And Rethreaded restores choice and breaks the cycle of generational trauma for survivors of human trafficking in Jacksonville, Florida, through business. You can help. Learn more about Rethreaded survivor-created goods at the storefront or rethreaded.com/shop.